You're listening to the What You Doin' Wilmington podcast, your favorite podcast, highlighting the positive people, places, and things in the beautiful city of Wilmington, North Carolina. Hosted by Demia Avery. I see you, we see you, and it's great to be seen. Great to be seen. Great to be seen.
Hello, 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 everyone. This is Demia Avery with What You're Doing North Carolina. And this podcast is designed to highlight the positive people, places, and things here in the beautiful state of North Carolina. I see you, we see you, and it's great to be seen. So we are continuing on with our exclusive interviews ahead of the North Carolina Film Festival. And I am also excited to bring on today's guest. He is an award-winning and Emmy-nominated filmmaker. Please welcome the amazingly gifted John Bedder of Bedrock Productions. Welcome to the show. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for having me, Demia. It's great to be here.
Oh, you're so welcome. Now, before we talk about your awesome body of work, walk us through your journey into documentary production. What drew you to this field?
Sure. Yeah. When I was young, I think I had some dreams about being a filmmaker, but they seemed so far and distant. So I decided to pursue music, actually, for a number of years. But at a certain point, a friend let me borrow their camera, their family camera, and I started making these short videos. And documentaries seemed like something that anyone could do. They didn't have the same kind of high-level production value that we're aware of in narrative film with actors. And so documentaries felt like a way that I could explore stories and things that were interesting to me without the need of all the money and resources that are required for Hollywood films.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to ask you what made you go independent as opposed to like working with a larger production company.
You know, when I got out of college, I was pretty sure that I wanted to do film, but I actually ended up working in retail for a lot of years. I worked at an Apple store. Okay. As many of us do in the arts, you find yourself at a job that pays the bills.
I did customer service at Apple one time.
Oh my goodness. I fixed iPhones and computers and would do a lot of customer service. I worked at the help bar a lot, which actually was great training to become a documentary filmmaker because it teaches you how to talk to anyone. It teaches you how to listen really carefully to what someone is trying to say versus what words might be coming out of their mouth.
Right.
And I've looked back many times at my time at Apple and thought, you know, all this like time talking to customers and trying to decipher what they're saying and helping them, you know, genuinely trying to help them, was training to listen to someone and figure out how do I get to the bottom of what they're really wanting to tell me. Is there more here? What questions should I ask? And also, how do I make sure that they're comfortable, that they're not angry? You know, so many people with a broken iPhone are upset.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you remember it's, you know, that's their life. And people come in and they're like, what's wrong? And they paid a lot of money for it. And, you know, you learn how to calm people down for sure. So that was funnily a lot of training for how to interview people. But I, you know, it really came down to just not having the resources. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll try and do it on my own. Mm-hmm. I do have friends who did the whole, became a production assistant, worked their way up, slowly became an assistant producer, associate producer, producer, director. Mm-hmm. And I have so much respect for the people who find themselves, you know, working their way up a ladder within the industry. But I had spent all this time, you know, not doing film that it kind of felt like, you know, I'm too old to do those things. I better just try to make a film. I'm glad I did, although I certainly could have learned a lot by, you know, just starting at a production company, being a production assistant. And there's still things that I don't know and aren't aware of. People use terms and things like that on sets. And I'm like, What did you just say? What's that acronym?
Yeah.
I have to Google that. So it's hindered me somewhat, but I also feel like just diving in and saying I'm going to make a film is part of the reason why I've been able to keep making them is because I just decided to go for it. So
You
yeah.
had so many lessons in what you just said. The first lesson that I took away from your answer is the fact that a lot of the time when we're going after our goals and our dreams, we have to take other jobs, jobs that we don't particularly care for in order to pay for the bills. And you took the positive out of that because a lot of times we're like, oh, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. But you took the positive out of it by saying, you know, I took something away from that. You know, I've learned how to work with customers. I learned how to deal with my situation and put that into, you know, into what I'm doing now. So I think that's a great way of looking at it and a great way of reminding ourselves that even though we may not be where we want to be right now, you can still learn some valuable lessons in where you are. You know what I mean?
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And for years I thought, oh, what a waste. I'm wasting time. I should be doing this. My peers, my friends are doing great things. I'm fixing a phone, getting yelled at by a customer. This doesn't feel like I'm progressing. But I always kind of thought, well, I'll try to do my job well, and so maybe I'll get better at it. And then now I realize, as long you can piece together skills from all kinds of things. I worked at a UPS store. I worked in restaurants. I worked at an Apple store. I was a musician for a long time. That taught me a lot, about working in the arts, working with other people and collaborating. And so many of those things that I thought were, oh gosh, I just wasted this many years, doing this, have absolutely turned into skills that I've relied upon and have helped me as a filmmaker. It's incredible.
Well, you also talk about patience, which is another thing. And then the last thing that I heard you mention is the fact of, am I getting too old? And a lot of people think that once you get to a certain age, that you've blown it. You know what I mean? You've blown it, that you can't do anything else. You might as well just start writing your obituary right now. And, just start thinking about retirement and or just settling for what you have now. So I appreciate your answer. It did have a lot of lessons in that. So I certainly appreciate that. Now, as I was doing research on your company, I noticed the different films that you worked on, and I noticed the range that you had. So, you had different types of documentaries and films and things like that. What is your approach to finding or selecting the different types of projects that you work on?
It's interesting because now it's very different than when I first started. When I first started, I knew that it had to be something, it didn't have to necessarily be a personal story, something about myself, but I had to have some sort of connection to it. Because I think the other ideas that had floated through my mind, oh, I should make a documentary about this or that, they would all fade. Time would go on, 6 months would go by, and I'd realize, oh, I never really did anything about that quote unquote great idea. So when I kind of stumbled upon the inspiration for my first film, which is about stage fright, so musicians dealing with stage fright, I was like, well, I know this problem intimately. As a musician, I've experienced it so many times. I could talk about it with a couple people while I was a musician, but it was very much a hush hush. We don't talk about that. You just get out there and you perform. And so I knew that that would carry me, that curiosity was enough fuel to get me through whatever it was going to take to make the movie, which was twice as much as what I thought it was going to be. It was so much harder than I thought it was going to be. But I still knew that, well, because all those other ideas faded, I'm going to need something that's really strong. And so the first film was was kind of just answering a big personal question of mine as to why I got so nervous doing something I loved so much for people that I thought, this is a great thing. I love being a musician and playing and performing music. So fast forward to now, I think I understand deeply, intimately, how much time, energy it takes to make one of these films. So now it's very different. And I heard a producer say this to me a few years ago, and it made me kind of sad, but I now have much more empathy for her response, which is, I choose films based on the ones I think I can make. And now that I understand how much goes into them, that is absolutely a much larger portion of how I decide on what to pursue. Certainly, am I passionate about it? Can I dedicate the time and curiosity that is needed for this? But it's also, can I raise enough money to make this film? That's a very real component of these films, is raising the money for them. And that's certainly become a reality of how I decide films from when I first started it. First, it was just, what am I curious about? And now it's, what am I curious about? And can I raise enough
What's
money
the
to actually
budget?
do that?
What's the budget for that? Which actually goes into my next question. So if you could pick a project, if you could pick a project that you've done so far, what would you say would have been the most difficult project that you had to work on from a producer or a director standpoint? And how would you say that you over came any obstacles or setbacks that you had?
It's possible that it's because it's the most recent film, but I do believe that the film that we're playing at the North Carolina Black Film Festival, titled How to Sue the Klan, is the most difficult film I've had to produce and work on. There's some obvious challenges emotionally, finding and retelling a story that's 40 years old. But it just, it's interesting. I think that because I had worked on projects before, that all of the knowledge that I had previously would come to help me and aid me, which it did. But I just don't think to the degree that I would need, which was, to raise a significant amount of money for this film in particular. I didn't want to make it like I made my first film, which was just go out, try to get whatever I could, hope for the best, plan for the worst, just see what comes out in the end. This film felt like I have a deep responsibility to other people, to an entire community, to a city, to families, to people who I will probably know for the rest of my life. And so, not that I didn't have that responsibility before, but there was some naiveness, and for sure, with this film, I felt all the responsibility. So I think combining the responsibility, the needing to have a real serious budget and resources to make the film, and the subject matter, of talking about the Klan and white supremacy, just all of those things really made it a challenging piece that, to be candid, was supposed to be a documentary feature. But I could never raise the money to create a documentary feature. So after a certain amount of time, we realized it's probably better to make a really great short documentary. Our film is 35 minutes long. Instead of waiting another 2, 3, 4, 5 years to raise the money necessary to make a feature, I still have some regrets about that. But I'm very proud of the film, and as much as I care about getting the story out and doing all of the justice to the families and the history, I'm also just very proud that we finished it. There's times when you're in the middle of these things and you think, uh-oh, like, what if we don't get this? What if we can't finish this? And it gets really scary. But the film is done and playing for audiences and getting reactions. So we feel a huge sense of accomplishment, even despite all the challenges and how difficult this was.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's something that I really wanted to get into. If you could, definitely, and for those who are viewing the podcast right now, I definitely wanted to get into. I knew that you were going to be showing this film at the NC Black Film Festival. So, for those of us that don't know, please just tell us what the film is and what the synopsis of the film is about.
Absolutely. The film is called How to Sue the Klan. As I said, it's a documentary short film, and it retells a forgotten piece of history nationally, but certainly here, even in Chattanooga. So I live here in Chattanooga, Tennessee. In 1980, four Black women were standing on the corner of a street when a group of Klansmen drove by and shot at them. They continued up the road and shot at another woman who was just tending to her garden outside of her home. The men were caught fairly quickly, but an all-white jury acquitted two of the men and sentenced the third to only a few months. This would lead to a pivotal civil trial that happened in 1982, which was led by the Center for Constitutional Rights, where they showed how to take down these white supremacist groups, which is by going after them for damages. Throughout the 80s and 90s, legal organizations took these white supremacist groups to civil court and won significant sums of money from them, limiting their ability to organize, taking their assets, and at the time, stopping what was then a rising movement of Klan groups. Today, we're seeing a resurgence of many of these groups. And in fact, lawyers like Mr. Ben Crump, who's a producer of the film, is using the same strategy that they used here in Chattanooga to combat modern day white supremacist groups. So we not only share this piece of history that's been forgotten, but also connect it to what is happening today in the hopes that more legal organizations and even citizens will use these laws to combat white supremacy in their own cities. And we're sad that the story was never shared, but this is our chance to retell it and to make sure that we give credit to Chattanooga, to the families, to the women, and to their legal team that won this incredible case.
Now, how challenging of this was this for you to take this on? Because obviously, I mean, of course, how can I say it? Of course, we know that most likely we would assume that more of an African American would take this on. So, of course, I'm looking at you that I mean, it's evident that you're an Asian American. Am I correct in saying that?
You are,
Okay.
yeah.
Well, how challenging of this of you was it for you to take this on?
That's a great question, and one that I've thought about for years, for sure, for while I've been making this film. Something that I think is important for us to talk about as much as possible is the fact that I do think that documentaries and many films should be made by the people represented in those films by way of their cultural history, location, race. I grew up in Boston. I'm an Asian American. I moved to Chattanooga in 2019. From the get-go, I did not think that I was the right person to make this film. I did feel a passion for producing it and thought that maybe I could help someone create this film. Certainly, my experience in kind of gathering the resources for creating a film seemed like they would be helpful to this. So I started doing that, and after 18 months, I could not find a director here in Chattanooga. We knew that someone had to be local. We knew that they had to have some experience in filmmaking, even if it was, they hadn't made a documentary. But when you're asking someone for years of their time, I hadn't raised any money at that point. I had only raised enough for us to kind of have conversations around the film. It was a hard sell, and many of the directors I spoke to were either busy or couldn't make that kind of financial sacrifice for the years that it was going to take, which is understandable. After about 18 months, we realized that it might be necessary for someone else to direct the film. Another really pivotal thing happened, which is one of the lawyers who worked on the film, Mr. George Harrison, passed away. And It really set about this race against time, in which we realized that if we look for the perfect scenario to make this film, we might lose the ability to tell this story. So we set about creating a local crew, created from people of color who live and work in the city, some background in documentary, some background in film, but no one had really worked on a project like this. And so the intention was, well, maybe we can create documentary filmmakers in the process of working on a documentary film here in Chattanooga. There's personal reasons as well for me wanting to make this film. It wasn't, wasn't lost on me in the midst of this film that Asian Americans were becoming victimized by white supremacists. It was an hour and a half south of me where a white supremacist went on a shooting spree at Korean spas north of Atlanta. And watching this happen, having many personal experiences, unfortunately, with racism, both violent and verbal harassment, it felt like something that I was okay with taking part in and being the director of, if I could do justice to the families. And so I talked to them and said, I haven't been able to find anyone. I really want to tell this story. Do you mind? Would it be all right if I tried to do it? And talking to the lawyers and the families, they said, yes, we want you to do it. We believe that you do justice and tell our truth. Having that responsibility, certainly made the film a reality for me, and I think for all of us. So I'm grateful that they allowed me to do that. But it's something I think about constantly is, am I the right person? Was I the right person? How do I make sure that next time the right person is available or I'm helping that those people?
I don't think, you know what, with all those things that has happened, I just, in just my opinion, all the things that happened, couldn't find anyone, and things didn't happen right, that it, obviously you were the one to tell the story. So we appreciated that. You know what I mean? As long as the story is told. As long as the story is told. And hey, that's, it is what it is. So appreciate it. That's all we're gonna say.
I appreciate you saying that. And, I'm someone who watches stories of Asian Americans and Asian people told by people who are, it's not reflective of the people in them. And it often upsets me. And I will try to understand why did that happen? Why wasn't there an Asian person to direct this? And if I can find good reasons, then I think, okay, maybe next time. I think for this film, it might be the same where it's, I think I'm certainly glad that I did it, but I would love to see this film and this story actually become other forms, maybe a narrative form where there are actors involved. And I certainly don't think I'd be the right person to direct that, but I do hope that I'm not the last person to tell this story.
Awesome. Now, I understand that your team, does your wife also work with you?
My wife does, yeah. She did a lot of the additional editing for the film, and something that you'll notice more in documentaries these days are animations or motion graphics. They kind of bring life to some of these old articles and images that we found from the 80s. So she did a lot of that, which was incredible. And I don't mind looking at an old photograph, but if you can add some things and edit them and make them really come to life again, then I think it's more meaningful to people to see them in that way. So we did a lot of that, and she's responsible for making those look beautiful.
Awesome, man. I love talking to couples that work together. Okay, so this is my personal question here. So who's the yin and who's the yang? So this is the thing. Okay, who's the bossy one and who's the one that's chill?
I think we rotate between those roles depending on what stage of the project we're on. I think in the start, it's me who's really driving the vision. And then by the time it's in the editing phase, which is, if half the film is maybe directing, the other half is editing, is kind of how I feel like. She takes charge.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it used to be where I could start to say, well, what about? And she's like, I already know what you're going to say. Here's why I've decided not to do that. And I go, okay, yeah, you're right. So I think we fall into the role that is necessary for the stage of the production that we're in, which worked out well for us, or so far has, for sure.
Now, what can we expect from your production company in the future?
So right now our main focus is getting this film, How to Sue the Clan, out to live audiences as much as possible. We hope someday to find a streaming partner where it can be available easily and publicly. We also have, you know, a few projects right now in development. We're trying to do projects that are focused on some form of science. It sounds so broad, but we've done a film in the medical space, a historical film, one about kind of mental health, and that one about stage fright. So this latest project we're doing is about human imagination.
Okay.
So apparently scientists have discovered that we all have varying degrees of imagination. Some of us have very vivid imaginations and can, in our mind's eye, see colors, shapes, details, landscapes, people, all kinds of things, and other people lack that ability completely and have no ability to visualize. And then, of course, many of us fall within that spectrum somewhere, but it's always been difficult to study imagination, but we're beginning to unravel how we imagine and the differences in how we imagine, and then, of course, what that means for individuals as far as how we experience the world. If you've ever had a friend who cannot remember directions and always gets lost, there's a good chance that they have what's called aphantasia, or lean that direction where they can't create mental imagery in their mind. And then I'm sure you've talked to other people who can, you know, remember some picture that they saw 20 years ago with incredible detail, and you wonder how are they able to remember that image and store that in their brain. And so those people lean more on the hyperphantasia side, where
Okay.
they can create vivid imagery. So we're documenting this and trying to see if we can turn it into a documentary.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So let me ask you this. So if you had to give some advice for any aspiring independent documentary producers or someone that's just starting out in the field or someone that's in the field and just still trying to just keep it moving, what advice would you give them?
You know, I've heard this advice given for other big events in your life, and I think it rings true for making a film too, which is that oftentimes it feels like you need all of the ingredients put out on your table in the right amounts, in the right order, before you can start cooking. You do not need to do that. And I'm living proof of that, of going, well, I've got a camera, so I'll just start doing this part. And then I'll figure out the next stage later. And I don't suggest this for everything, but I certainly think there were years that I spent thinking, well, I don't have the right ingredients. I can't make a film. I don't have this. I can't make a film. I don't have that. I can't make a film. And by the time that I was so frustrated, and honestly, I don't mind admitting this, but it felt like I was just so ashamed of not making a film for so many years. You know, so many of my friends would say, weren't you going to make a film? You know, you've been working for Apple for 6 years. You know, when's that filmmaking career going to start? That it was actually just deep regret that built up enough to say, I don't need the ingredients. I'm just going to start. I'm going to YouTube everything I don't know, Google every question I can think of as far as how to make a documentary, what camera to buy, how to interview someone, you know, what lights, what microphone to use. You know, how to write a release, what is a release? You know, I just started going down the line, and would figure it out as I went. And by the time I finished the film, I was so grateful that I didn't wait for more ingredients to come about, because I would have never made it. And the second one, you can gather more of the right ingredients, you know, but don't worry about that first one. And yeah, I've appreciated how much regret actually went into me making that first film and just deciding I have to do this.
And look, and then you end up getting Emmy nominated. Isn't that something?
That was an incredible moment for sure. Yeah, I'll never forget that night. That was incredible.
Now, what did you get Emmy nominated for?
So my second film was about palliative care, pediatric palliative care, so end of life care for children and families who have a terminal diagnosis. And that film was co-produced by the New York Times. And so they submitted it for the News and Documentary Emmys. I actually didn't know. And so someone from the New York Times just emailed me and said, "I'm so proud of you, and this is so great." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And they were like, "Look on Twitter, look on the news." And I think two of their films had been nominated that year, so it was a huge deal. And yeah, it's just, it was my second film, so you can imagine having made the first one, thinking, "I can't believe I just made one film." The second one to go on to be an Emmy nominee was far, far beyond my dreams, and I'm
Did you
so
lose your
grateful
mind that
to
day?
making.
Did you lose your mind that day when you saw
I
it?
it filled so many holes, that I feel like I had dug somewhere within myself in a single moment. And
Yeah.
you do realize that others it doesn't fill. I'm still making films, I'm still trying to fund and produce films.
Yeah.
But it just all those 6 years working at Apple,
Yeah.
suddenly I didn't feel that regret. I felt, no, that was on purpose. I was supposed to, get spit on by customers and have them yelling and do all of that time and energy work to be here for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an incredible moment. We didn't win, which I
It
was
doesn't
surprised at
matter.
how
You didn't
sad I
win. You didn't
was.
win that night, but you're but on your way.
Exactly.
On your way.
Oh,
Yeah.
that too, I felt like I don't need, if I get this again, it'll be special. But just being nominated, I realized I don't, this is an achievement of a lifetime. I think I'm okay with this. So
Absolutely.
now it's just about making better and better films.
Awesome. So listen, everybody, from Apple to Emmys. All right, well, listen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to thank John Better. I want to thank his wife. Hey guys, thanks for coming out to the NC Black Film Festival. Make sure you guys get your tickets so you can go and see. Is it going to be the actual movie or is it going to be like the trailer? Is it going to be the actual movie?
The full movie, we're
Awesome.
Saturday, May 18th at 4:45.
Awesome. So look, I want to invite you back when you have something else you want to promote or anything else like that. Come
Yes,
back.
please.
Awesome. All right, guys, we are out of here. Home is where the heart is, and my heart is in North Carolina. See you guys later. Bye-bye.